think if you know, the president and co-executive director of progressivechristianity.org, a national organization. And this year in particular, we felt like it was important for us to identify political hot button topics that very conservative groups in the church are trying to lay claim to and say that they understand the biblical way of approaching it, and we're trying to provide a counter message of what we believe biblically is really true. Today we're going to be talking about reproductive rights. So you can guess that we'll be dealing with some pretty heavy topics. Fortunately, you know, sometimes difficult to put words to those, and music conveys the emotional parts of it and gives us room to hear what's being said through the music. And so we're fortunate enough that Stephanie's given us a couple of extra pieces of music today, so you'll get to participate in thinking about this topic that way.
Since the Dobbs decision, there have been a lot of abortion songs that have been written. And one of the most striking ones that came from the country music world was by she's a bluegrass musician that she performed at the festival here in Greensboro a couple years ago. I didn't know about her, but she's quite amazing. She's kind of a rising star in the American Root movement. There's this song called Goodbye Mary. It's a track from her new album called City of Gold. It creates the intimate portrait of a woman's struggle for bodily autonomy that captures the potential terror of a post-Roe America. And this one is the one that's been most currently and recently written. When you hear it, you're not going to think that, but that's true. It chronicles the aftermath of a love affair between Thomas and Mary. It recounts Thomas's abandoning the pregnant Mary, who chides him for failing to keep his promise to build a cradle soon, sending her directions on where to find an abortionist who refuses to perform the procedure because the baby's too far along, encouraging Mary to fling herself down the stairs or ride careless down a rocky road, and saying that he prays for her soul after she finds and uses a wire in the old tool shed to abort the fetus. And in the final verse, she asks him from the confines of her jail cell to place pretty flowers on her grave. And this last twist shifts the narrative from being solely a tale about the tragic failure of a man to own his part in the conception and destruction of their fetus. It becomes a more layered statement about a woman's grief when she's pushed to unbearable choices and her need to balance control of her own body with the legal and psychological guilt imposed by society when she takes the only means of control open to her. The result is an intimate portrait of a woman navigating a complex landscape made more perilous by the erasure of her rights. So this is Goodbye Mary. And all of that came from a blog article online.
Goodbye Mary, I must go where I'm bound, I don't know. Here's a ticket and my mother's golden ring. Golden ring, ring. Here's a ticket and my mother's golden ring. Oh, Thomas, you're a liar. You betray me with desire. Promise to build a rocker soon. A rocker soon. Soon. You promise to build a cradle soon. Worry, Mary, rest your head. Take the train, like I said. Change to Scottsville for the old Red River. River line, change in Scottsville for the old Red River line. Damn you, Thomas, and the rest, it's more than distress. The doctor said the baby. babies too far along. Too far along.
Two readings that I want to share with you this morning. The first comes from the Gospel of Matthew, chapter 22, verses 37 through 40. And I'm reading from the NRSV. Hear now these words. He said to him, Jesus said, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all of your mind. This is the greatest and first commandment. And the second is like it." And in the Greek here, the word that is interpreted as "is like it" is really closer to it. And the second is almost exactly the same as it. And that is, "You shall love your neighbor as yourself. On these two commandments hang all the law and the prophets." Then a short quote from the Dalai Lama, who said, "The rationale for loving others is the recognition of the simple fact that every living being has the same right to and the same desire for happiness and not suffering, and the consideration that you are one life unit as compared with in their ceaseless quest for happiness."
In 1993, in the midst of when we were in the middle of Roe v. Wade, Cyndi Lauper released a song called "Sally's Pigeons." It's inspired by a real-life incident where the pop singer's friend got a back-alley abortion after becoming pregnant and died due to the attempted procedure. So after the Supreme Court's Dobbs ruling, after it was leaked to Politico, Lauper headed back into the studio to record an updated acoustic version of "Sally's Pigeons." And this is what Cyndi Lauper had to say about her new version. "The Supreme Court's radical decision Commission today makes the re-recording and release of Sally's Pigeons more relevant than ever. In my childhood, freedom, and 50 years later, we find ourselves in a time when freedom to control their own body. When I wrote this song, with one who dreamt of stretching their wings like the pigeons they watched that flew above them. They dreamt of being free, but freedom then for women, and unfortunately now, comes at a big price. If we don't have control over our own bodies, then we have no real freedom. We are second-class citizens. We need to mobilize. We need to let our voices be heard. Cindy Walters. And the lovely Kate there is going to sing this little song. When I was eight, I had a frigid vibrant smile. Make believe and we were innocent and wild. Hopped around the gate, running down my alleyway in time to watch Sally's pigeons fly. Love to watch them dive and soar, circling the sky. Free as a bird from freedom over and never knowing why. Never fold their watch back in, pull away by their barring and can. Look out over it while Sally's pigeons fly.
Message this morning is entitled Pro-Life. Up front, that I recognize that this is a controversial. People are going to disagree with my perspective. But I also recognize that we all can be adult about having differences of opinion and still get along just fine. Not only that, most of us value the teachings of Jesus, and as we heard in today's scripture, we are called to love one another, and yes, even if we disagree with one another. Because of the topic, I also want to acknowledge up front that I am a cisgendered male. I recognize that that alone eliminates me from being a full authority or a fully authoritative voice on the question of reproductive rights. However, when I look what has happened to reproductive rights since the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade, I think it is inexcusable, and I do mean inexcusable, to not address the subject publicly. And I say this, I hate that I feel like I always have to say this, but I think it has to be repeated over and over again. I do not recommend someone, anyone, getting health information or making health decisions based on a collection of books, most of which were written more than 2,000 years ago. But if you so, particularly when it comes to the question of reproductive rights, at least be honest about what the books actually. First, let's talk about abortion during biblical times. It turns out that abortions were practiced during those times. Now, admittedly, their methods didn't benefit from all the biological and scientific discovery the way that they do now, but abortions were practiced nonetheless. For example, there was one Greek physician who would prescribe fasting, bloodletting, vigorous jumping, and carrying heavy loads as a way to the end of pregnancy. But fortunately, we now have, as I said, healthier options in modern times. But the important point is that when the Bible was written, society was very aware of abortion and had words for it. The thing is, in the Bible, in both the Hebrew and the Greek, the word for abortion simply does not appear. You have to ask yourself, if abortions were regularly practiced in biblical times, and there was even words for it, if the writers of the Bible were so against it, like conservative Christians are so intense on insisting is the case, if the writers of the Bible were so against it, wouldn't they have used the word from time to time? Well, the answer is obviously yes, they would. But they didn't. Not even once. So that's food for thought. But if you insist still on looking at what the Bible has to say about a woman and her fetus, we can do that as well. First of all, the New Testament doesn't directly deal with the issue of abortion or even when life begins. And in the Old Testament or the Jewish Bible, it turns out, is not to be thought of as an anti-abortion text either. Not at all, as a matter of fact. In Genesis, it actually says that life begins at first breath, so at birth. In the 21st chapter of Exodus, a fetus is not given equal rights or even greater rights to that of the mother. In Numbers, it even says that in the case of adultery, fetuses should be aborted as proof of the adultery. And there's several other examples of fetuses not being given the same rights as the mother, but I think you're getting the point here. So, those that are hoping to use the Bible to take away reproductive rights, well, they really aren't following the Bible very closely. But let's be clear here. Religion isn't actually the reason that folks who hold an anti-abortion perspective do so. a big part of why they do it is actually politics, specifically misogynistic politics. It is particularly uncaring, unloving, male-dominated perspective that forces women to risk their plans for their future every time they have sex, and that is not the case for men. It gives fetuses more rights than the person who is pregnant. It denies what could be life-saving care to those in need, and it can also deny many folks economic stability, stable mental health, and even a safe home environment. That does not sound very caring to me. One thing the Bible definitely stands for and was the core of Jesus' teaching is loving our neighbor, just as we heard in today's scripture. The anti-reproductive rights stance definitely is not loving towards others. And so, despite some people's attempt to misuse and twist biblical texts, being anti-reproductive rights definitely does not sound biblical to me. But let's dig even a little deeper. I'd like to start with a quote from a minister in Alabama. In 2018, he made a Facebook post about those who claim to be pro-life, and it went viral. And I believe the reason it went so viral that so many people wanted to share it is because of how insightful and revealing it was about the pro-life movement. So let me share his post with you. This is what he said. The unborn, his quotes, are a convenient group of people to advocate for. They never make a demand of you. They are morally uncomplicated, unlike the incarcerated, addicted, or the chronically poor. They don't resent your condescension or complain that you are not politically correct. Unlike widows, they also don't ask you to question patriarchy. Unlike orphans, they don't need money, education, or child care. Unlike aliens, they don't bring all that racial, cultural, and religious baggage that you dislike. They allow you to feel good about yourself without any work at creating or maintaining relationships. And when they are born, you can just forget about them because they cease to be unborn. It's almost as if by being born, they have died to you. You can love the unborn and advocate for them without substantially challenging your own wealth, power, or privilege, without reimagining social structures, apologizing, or making reparations to anyone. They are, in short, the perfect people to love if you want to claim you love Jesus, but actually dislike people who breathe. Prisoners, immigrants, the sick, the poor, widows, orphans, all the groups that are specifically mentioned in the Bible, they all get thrown under the bus for the unborn. I have to agree with Reverend Barnhart. The pro-life movement cares very little about the sanctity of life. Just look at how they abandon pro-lifeism when pregnancy puts someone's life at risk. More times than not, they prefer what they perceive as the rights of the fetus over the life of the person who is carrying it. Think about that. I mean, how did we arrive at a point where far too many conservatives believe that it is a radical idea to think that a pregnant person should be valued as a person? That simply does not sound like someone who is actually pro-life to me. I mean, if you truly want to be pro-life, if you want to do so in a way that adheres to the teachings of Jesus, let's start with mandating living wages, actually paying employees at a rate that would allow them to make a reasonable life for themselves and not constantly be risking life and limb because of the realities of living at or below the line of poverty. If you truly want to be pro-life, let's ensure that employees have paid sick leave, paid maternity leave, and paid family leave. That is the loving thing to do. That is the thing that truly shows that you value the sanctity of life. If you truly want to be pro-life, let's provide universal health care and end the senseless and avoidable deaths of 68,000 Americans who die every year due to a lack of access to the health care they desperately need. That's the loving thing to do. That is the thing that shows you you truly value the sanctity of life. The list of truly pro-life needs that aren't supported by most folks who consider themselves to be pro-life can go on and on. Things like reasonable gun control laws, strong anti-poverty laws, publicly funded childcare centers, more robust sex education programs and access to birth control, immigration law that values the lives of the immigrants rather than treating them like enemy number one and leaving them in less than livable conditions. If you truly want to be pro-life, these are the kinds of things you need to be demanding if you want me to believe that you are actually pro-life. Clearly, the sanctity of life isn't really what motivates the majority of pro-life folks. So what is it beyond simply politics? Well, I mentioned it a bit earlier. And according to a poll from 2019, the answer is as literally straightforward as you think it might be: misogyny. In the poll, folks who, and this is important, they polled only folks who self-identified as pro-life. And in that poll, over and over again, they responded to poll questions in a way that clearly indicated they had, the majority had misogynistic outlooks. In the poll, only 31% of Republicans who identified as pro-life said that bans on reproductive rights caused them to consider women's rights and equality at all. Only 10% of pro-life men were outraged or angry about full bans on abortion. 77% of the folks who want full abortion bans believe that, quote, 77%, quote, women are too easily offended. And 71% believe that most women interpret innocent remarks or acts as being sexist. So it should not be surprising that less than 35% of pro-lifers polled throughout and thought that the way women are treated in society should be an important election issue. Or that it shouldn't surprise you that 23% of pro-life folks think that the lack of women in politics and political office affects women's equality. Even more telling is the less than 28% of pro-lifers who said that the lack of access to birth control affects the equality of women. These very folks also want to believe that their anti-choice stance is somehow biblical, while it seems to be clearly motivated in part by misogyny. Here's the thing, though. Women are frequently powerful biblical characters in ministry. For a text that was written during a time that did not see women equal to men, that's if women were the only followers that were recorded to stay with Jesus as he was crucified. In the story that way that John tells it, a woman's the first to see the resurrection of Jesus. Galatians 3:2-8 makes it clear that there is no longer male or female, but rather that all are equal. There are more examples, but the point is, misogyny is not a biblical value in the New Testament. It follows then, along with the other things that I've mentioned, that taking away rights from a woman, particularly on issues that are motivated by misogyny, cannot be understood as a biblical approach in any way. So, is being pro-life biblical? Absolutely not. I mean, truth be told, it's not even actually pro-life. It is misogynistic politics trying to use Christianity as a cover. It is an uncaring, unloving, misogynistic perspective that forces women to risk their plans for their future every time they have sex. Again, that's not the case for men. It gives fetuses more rights than the person who is pregnant. It denies what could be life-saving care from those in need, and denies many folks economic stability, stable mental health, and even a safe home environment. That, my friends, is decidedly unloving. It looks nothing like loving your neighbor. So no, absolutely, 100%, unequivocally, being pro-life is not biblical. And you should never let anyone suggest to you that it is.
In 2019, pre the Dobbs decision, Amanda Palmer wrote a song called Voicemail for Jill. And this post is by somebody who was in the video for this song. She says, although this post is about my experience of being part of this video, it's also my sincere hope that a key takeaway is how important the song and video are, especially now as attempts are being made all over the country to dismantle abortion rights. The struggle is not only real, it's terrifying. Voicemail for Jill is about abortion and supporting rather than shaming women who have them. Amanda Palmer wrote the song, says she's been trying to write such a song for many years. The song is structured as Amanda leaving a voicemail message from London to her friend Jill on the morning of Jill's abortion in Boston. The message offers support, love, friendship, empathy, and even the promise of a party, an abortion shower. Voicemail for Jill isn't hell-bent on being a stripper, at least in my opinion, according to this woman, one that is focused on abortion. No one's happy about getting an abortion. It offers a lifeline to women misunderstood, villainized, threatened, and judged. She says, I'm going to share again what Amanda, who wrote the song, had said before the video was made. In Amanda's words, this video, if I get it right, feels like it will be more than just a video. It will be a love letter. It will be a message in a bottle to women everywhere. It will be a thing. I really. Amanda Palmer's song, Voicemail. And I know you're in hell, and I know what you're feeling. Life's such a bitch, isn't it? When you have a baby, they throw you a party, and when then you die. I'm not sure that you'll get this in time. I don't know if you're checking your voicemail at all, but in case it's the morning and you're off at the green line and walking through Copley, I want you to stop for a second. I want you to listen. You don't need to offer the right explanation. You don't need to beg for redemption or ask for forgiveness. And you don't need a courtroom inside of your head when you're acting as judge and accused and defendant and witness. It's a strange grief, but it's grief. Look at all the women in the street. You know the statistics, Jill. Even though they may not help, isn't it amazing how we can never tell who is in an identical hell?
Gender male in 1993. Also, the same year that Cyndi Lauper wrote Salvation's Time. Yeah. I never heard of them, but apparently they became a really cool thing when a tribe called Quest was coming up. Kind of the time hip hop was in a certain evolution and kind of jazz was kind of infused. Dingle Planet wrote a song called, or performed a song, or recorded a song called A Femme Fatale, kind of spelled A Femme. And here's an online article wrote by a guy named Stereo Williams in just 2022. Stereo Williams is a veteran entertainment journalist for a lot of platforms like The Daily Beast and Ebony, and a frequent guest on SiriusXM's Tell Me Everything. So according to this article that Stereo Williams wrote, here is Clarence Thomas, quote, in the year 2000. Clarence Thomas says, in 1973, this court struck down an act of the Texas legislature that had been in effect since 1857, thereby rendering unconstitutional abortion statutes in dozens of states. As some of my colleagues on the court, past and present, ably demonstrated, that decision was grievously wrong. Abortion is a unique act in which a woman's exercise of control over her own body ends, depending on one's view, human life, or potential human life. Nothing in our federal constitution deprives the people of this country of the right to determine whether the consequences of an abortion to the fetus and to society outweigh the burden of an unwanted pregnancy on the mother. Although a state may permit abortion, nothing in the Constitution dictates that a state must do so. See, back in 1992, Justice Clarence Thomas was the controversial newly sworn-in justice who intended to overturn Roe v. Wade. On Planned Parenthood versus Casey, 1992 decision that reaffirmed the right to abortion, he was a dissenter. 1992 was an explosive year politically. The 1992 presidential election conveniently positioned Arkansas Governor Bill Clinton as the fresh youthful change agent against President George H.W. Bush's established old fogyism and conservative platform. In late 1991, Justice Thomas himself had been at the center of the Anita Hill hearings, which put women's issues and sexual harassment under a national spotlight. And Rodney King verdict led to violent uprisings in major American cities that spring, most notably in Los Angeles. Remember 1992? In early 1993, Digable Planets suddenly became one of the year's breakout artists. This song, I bet you've heard this song, called Rebirth the Slit, Cool Like That. It made this trio of artists who called themselves Butterfly, Ladybug Mecca, and Doolook. Made these guys stars. They're really jazz artists if you listen to them talk and their lyrics. On their debut album, which is called Reachin', A New Reputation of Time and Space. It's a jazz rap, they're jazz rap critical darlings. They included a song, this song, that tackled an issue that most rap albums weren't addressing at all at the time. La Femme Fatale featured Butterfly, his name is actually Ish, rhyming in an almost spoken word, sharing an anecdote about a woman named Nikki, who found herself and her boyfriend in the uncomfortable position of having to consider aborting her pregnancy. They used a sample by Jimi Hendrix and Lightning Rod. Butterfly offers words of his best friend. So this is from a male's perspective. He also can be artist. Also, those who would criticize and condemn her, chastising the fascists as some heavy dudes. They just don't want a woman to control her body. Or have them. As pundits and watchdogs for violent and misogynistic lyrics, here was a rap group offering an empathetic and insightful take on women's rights and a difficult issue that so many communities of color in particular have often been faced with. So Stereo Williams says when he was in high school, he had just bought Reachin', and when he first heard La Femme Fatale, Stereo Williams, an African-American man, he said, I was becoming heavy into jazzy hip-hop. A Tribe Called Quest and Digable Planets were a cool cerebral act that seemed to echo that legendary group's vibe. La Femme Fatale was one of the first songs on the album that he learned all the words to, and it meant a lot to him. His message was profound with Stereo Williams. So here I'm going to try to do this. It was 8:49 on a beautiful ninth day of July. There was not a cloud to speak of, so the orange sun hung lonely in the sky. I lay prone in my cabby home, thinking of fine after Jackie and his jazz gas horn, sliding a tape of bird on bird, when suddenly rang my phone. Hey, butterfly, the voice said, slip on some duds, come at the crow, and slide on down to my pad. The vibe here is very pleasant, and I truly request your presence. A problem of great magnitude has arose, and as we speak, it grows. Damn, what could it be, I thought, a juice I bought, and rolled on down to her spot. Seeing rows I know, slapping thighs I arrived, and I pressed G5, and there was Nikki, looking some kind of sad, the tears falling from her eyes. She sat me down and dug my frown and began to run it down. You remember my boyfriend Sid, that fly kid who I love? Well, our love was often a bird, and spontaneity has brought a third. But due to our youth and economic state, we wish to terminate. About this, we don't feel great, but baby, that's how it is. But the feds have dissed me. They ignored and dismissed me. The pro-lifers harass me outside the clinic and call me a murderer. Now that's me. So needless to say, we're in a mental state of debate. Hey, beautiful bird, I said, digging for somber mood. The fascists are some heavy dudes. They don't really give a damn about life. They just don't want a woman to control her body or have the right to choose. Baby, that ain't nothing. They just want a male finger on the button. Because if you say war, they will send them to die by the score. Aborting the mission should be your volition. But if Souter and Thomas have their way, you'll be standing in line unable to get welfare while they'll be out hunting fishing. It has always been around. It will always have a niche. But they'll make it a privilege, not a right, accessible only to the rich. Hey, pro-lifers need to dig themselves because life doesn't stop after birth. And for a child born to be unprepared, it might even get worse. The situation would surely change if they were to find themselves in it. Supporters of the H-bomb and firebomb and clinics. What type of crap is that? Orwellian, in fact. If Roe v. Wade was overturned, would not the desire remain intact, even girls, to risk their health, doctors to botch and watch as they kill themselves? Now, I hate to sound macabre, but hey, isn't it my job to lay it on the masses and get them off their asses? To fight against these fascists. So whatever you decide, make that move with pride. It'll be there, and so will I. An insect till I die, this little butterfly. Rhythms and sounds, spinning around. Confrontations across the nation. Your block, my block, dreadlocks, what a shock. Land of the free, but not me, not me.
It is easy to get so caught up in the business and troubles of our own lives that we forget we are called to be transformers for justice in this world. There's so much pain, so much loneliness, so much sickness, so much loss, so much injustice in this world that it can sometimes seem like just the way things are. Let us never forget that creation contains the possibility of heaven on earth, a fellowship of humanity. Let us never forget that the teachings of Jesus, as well as the teachings of so many other great spiritual leaders, can lead us to a world where suffering is greatly reduced. And as we remember those teachings, may we be more aware of the places where our laws and treatment of others are particularly unloving. And may we be moved to demand just and loving laws. May we learn to not only confront injustices, but to help those who suffer, and to be open to receiving comfort when we are the ones suffering. Amen. Receive this blessing. May you walk in harmony with each other and creation, recognizing that we are one. And may you know love and happiness throughout your life. May your words and actions bring that love and happiness to all of those you meet.
For Charlene. She wanted me to do Amazing Grace. And I told Nancy last week, I got kind of a cool version of Amazing Grace. So I did my cool version of Amazing Grace for Charlene.
Mm-hmm.